in the positive, and we're just wanting again to go back into all those negative ways of thinking. And it was almost like right in front of us we were seeing the necessity for a community, because we were seeing the need for people of like mind to get together and to reinforce themselves in the values that were important to them. It was a very interesting moment. You remember, Stephanie, you were there?
I was at work that day.
You were at work that day. It is a famous moment. By the time we came back, it was no longer an open forum. By the time we came back, we had it all structured, because we just couldn't. We could see, and it's partly what Swamiji himself talks about when we get into the next chapter. You know, Swami puts a lot of emphasis on leadership, and he said it over and over and over again, the most difficult issue in the proliferation of communities is leadership. Because, he writes again, every institution is the length and shadow of one person. He even says communities need to be started by one dedicated individual and a few who are in tune with his ideals. And his whole story, the chapter last week about Machiavelli, by contrast, just talking over and over about what qualities are required for individuals to be able to inspire others to be able to do it. And leadership is a skill, and he also emphasizes so much in that last chapter, in the Machiavelli chapter, by contrast, that leadership is a specific skill that can be developed, and working with people in this particular way is something that you can think about it if you think about it in the right way and can do it. And often Swamiji really spends a lot of his time thinking, how can communities be started without leaders who have that much skill? And he even ponders, if Master said this idea will spread like wildfire, how can it possibly spread like wildfire since there's only a handful of people who can really establish communities? And one thought that Swami just said recently was that they could be very small. Communities could be very small, just, 15, 20 people, just a few families together. Master himself spoke of getting together with a few friends and buying land in the country, and perhaps not being as ambitious, in their model. And the second reality is once the thought form gets going, the first groups always have to establish everything. And through the history of Ananda, we've had to establish everything. Even here, Swami has to work so hard to just break down very basic ideas, such as the thought, that if it's a good idea, it can be done on a mass scale. And that's why he starts, living things begin small. And that you test out your ideas and you practice them in a small environment with like-minded people instead of blowing up these big theories and then trying to impose them on everyone. He's sort of trying to get us to be practical in this. Will it really work? If we're really going to establish these communities, can we do it? Can we really make it happen? He points out quite obviously that even Christianity just started with one person. And it is really quite remarkable when you think about the fact that what you always point to is individuals. Even the communist system was started by a few individuals who had that thought first and put forward that thought. Everything begins in a little way, and in many ways simply loses its power. As he says, one of the worst things that happened to Christianity was that Constantine declared it the state religion. And so instead of it being a matter of individual inspiration, it became ever thereafter a matter of mandate, state mandate. And I love what Swami says, mass conversions are a travesty, because how can a mass of people capture something that really has to be so much a matter of individual conscience? And it also just sort of takes us back from this thought that success is not necessarily measured by vast numbers of people. Success is measured by the depth or sincerity of a handful of people who really understand what they're doing. I mean, sometimes when we look at Ananda, we get caught in the thought that it needs to be larger than it is. I think part of that is that we need to be expansive in our thinking, and we as individuals need to keep reaching out and finding ways to communicate and touch other people's lives. But that doesn't mean it will necessarily be better for being bigger. In fact, over some time at Ananda Village, there was sort of a sense that one of the things that happened at that community at a certain point was it got just a little too big. And it just was difficult to keep track of it. And after that, I mean, the village is bigger than this, but Swami spoke of about 100 people. It's about as big as, 100 people is as many people as can move as a group. And even 100, you start dividing into smaller vortices of energy. I know at a certain point with Ananda Village, he said, we're just too big to be small anymore, and the only hope of being small is to get bigger, to get big enough to create small entities within it, or even to break it up into smaller entities. One of Swamiji's ideas that he proposed once for development was to develop many small communities all along Tyler Foot Road up there. That was more based on the thought of Swamiji being there and the people not wanting to go far away. He solved that by going to Europe. But that you would create just many little entities, neighborhoods or whatever you were going to call it, many small churches instead of a few large ones, because then they can really have the personality of the individuals involved. After that, of necessity, you have to lose that individuality because you're trying to move too many around. I know in our schools, they talk about the point at which the group of children, it becomes more about managing the herd than it is about relating to the individuals, and sort of what that critical mass is, where it's traffic control more than it is real education. And so, again, one of the thoughts we have to have in our mind is that small is beautiful, and that the very nature of community may demand that it remain little rather than that the whole world absorb it. And merely the fact that the whole world doesn't embrace it doesn't mean that it isn't still the ideal we should strive for. I'd like to take a short break, if I may. The next section, Living Things, begins small. Again, a lot of what Swamiji is talking about here is leadership. And he's talking about leadership on many levels that are very interesting. He's talking about, what kind of a leader can be effective. And he talks about the necessity for a leader to, as he puts it, to live what he preaches, which is a sort of an obvious statement. But so much of the time, we're willing to believe people who don't actually embody what it is they're expressing. And again, these are these crazy sort of missteps that get going in our mentality, where if someone doesn't believe enough in what they're saying to actually live it themselves, then you have to be very suspicious about it. Not that you have to judge them for it, but you have to be very suspicious about embracing it. Anybody can spin out theories. It's very easy to just write something that sounds good, but it's very much more difficult to write something that a person can actually live by. And that's the magnetism of Ananda, really, is that it isn't about what people say they're doing, it's about what people are actually doing. And oftentimes they don't really articulate it very well, but you see it after a while. I know it's been sort of fun for me over the years, because it takes a while to trust it, and I watch people sort of gradually go through years and just realizing the quality of the friendship and the quality of the spiritual teaching and the quality of the commitment to one another is just unusual. It's not what you find in any other setting, but it's really based on really understanding the practical value of what we're doing and why wouldn't we do it this way. And Swami talks about the power that comes. There's a sentence here that I just particularly loved. He talks about how the balance between, this is a paragraph that I marked, he said, no human beings can be forced to behave contrary to their own nature, which is to say you can't, this is what I was saying earlier, you can't just tell people that this is how they have to behave. He said, at the same time, if you just stand back and let everybody do what they want to do, you also don't make any progress. And this is the line that Swamiji is always trying to draw between this tremendous respect for personal diversity and freedom and the fact that we are going somewhere. And that's the unique contribution, in a sense, that Ananda and the path of self-realization have. It's not that there is no direction, but nor is it so that you can regiment the way that direction will be found. And he said you can at least inspire people in the right direction. You might not be able to inspire them all the way to the goal, but you can inspire them in the right direction. And then he gives, especially if the one guiding them, as he says, views the people he's relating to as dear to him rather than outside the circle of his sympathy. Now think how what a contrast that is to what he was talking about earlier. He was talking about Stalin and others like that. I mean, the people are mere statistics. People are mere statistics, and if they don't fit in with the plan, then they are literally annihilated, and millions of people have been killed. Part of what he's also trying to stir us to is a sense of outrage at what has been done in the name of these ideal societies, so we don't get confused between mass murder and genuine inspiration. But just the simple phrase that the people he is guiding can't be outside the circle of his sympathy. And any one of us who finds ourselves in a leadership position, you have to always think that. You know, am I treating these people as things that are outside the circle of my sympathy? And once again, you look at the miracle of Swami's leadership of so many people, is that he always considers everyone to be within the circle of his sympathy. And you just feel that. You feel like you're not being sacrificed. And in fact, once when he was asked, what is the role of the spiritual director of Ananda? He said, to protect the individuals from the institution. Yeah. Isn't that an interesting answer for the person who's the head of the institution, in a sense? But he said it so that there's never any thought that the organization takes precedence over the needs of the people, because there is no such thing as that. I mean, sometimes people can't always get what they want because there has to be a moving force, but you can still keep them within the circle of your sympathy. And then he talks about, he goes for this long thing about people power, which is a very interesting phrase, and he starts talking about mass movements and mob psychology and emotions and things like that. And it's actually very subtle what he's talking about here, because most of us are not out with lynch mobs and we're not part of the French Revolution anymore or anything like that, although some of us may have been. In fact, a psychic told me that one of the reasons that I have to talk so much now is that I used my persuasive abilities to persuade people to the wrong things. She actually said I helped start the French Revolution. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I hope even then I was wiser than that. But having persuaded people to do the wrong thing, I have to continually try to persuade them to do the right thing now, which would be the karmic retribution for that sort of wrong action. But Swami tries to make this difference between the emotionalism that can organize a group. And he says this single phrase that the best thing that mob emotion can produce is the feeling that somebody ought to do something. And that was sort of a more recognizable response. You know, how many times have you been with groups of people where you all end up feeling that somebody ought to do something and that we're going to see that somebody does something, but no individual actually is inspired with a solution? And one of the things that Swamiji emphasizes that the role of the leader has to be is to keep people solution-oriented. And being solution-oriented is another one of those sort of Ananda mottos that has been such a part of the way we operate. There's a thought form that's very prevalent in our society that unless you're focused on the problems, you're not really going to be able to solve them. But the difficulty with that is that when you are oriented toward problems, you tend to just see more problems. And it's sort of like a whole mindset. I remember when I was giving a seminar in a corporate setting, and I wanted people to focus on their strengths and think about how they were going to put dynamic energy into their strengths. And I found that people, for the most part, couldn't do that. They could only talk to me about their weaknesses, and they could only talk to me about the problems that they were facing. They couldn't talk about the solutions that were inherent within them to solve those problems, because there was this enormous sense that if I don't focus on the negative, I'm being irresponsible, and that there's no way for the problem will never be solved. But Swamiji points out that the job of the leader is to keep the energy going in a positive, magnetic way, because it's really the energy of solutions that draw more solutions, and the energy of problems just draw the energy in a downwardly spiraling manner. And so he gives that responsibility to those who are in charge, and he also speaks to the fact that most people are problem-oriented. That's just the way the mind works. And he talks about sort of the way you run a group situation and he attacks a number of sacred cows, such as brainstorming sessions, and saying, if you're in charge of something, don't ever say to a group of people, what shall we do? It's sort of interesting the way he says that. Don't ever say to a group unless you already have a clear idea of what you should do. And just I've watched over the years with Swamiji that he draws people's energy in, and he describes, he's so interesting what he articulates here. He talks about how most people cannot really initiate a new idea, that they have to rely upon others. There's only a handful of people who can really create new things. But many people can improve upon existing ideas. He said, especially if you give them the opportunity. And then he adds the other thing. Many people have good insights, but they don't have the habit of being able to articulate their thoughts. But if you give them the opportunity, said especially through one-on-one conversation, and really listen, then you can find sometimes that people have a lot to contribute. Now, all of this also indicates it's not merely specifically of interest, but it also indicates the extreme care for the individual that an effective leader needs to have. And any of us who've been fortunate enough in any circumstance to be with an effective leader realize that that kind of care is needed, or else individuals end up feeling that they're not part of it. I've known for years Swamiji will call lots and lots of people, or have meetings, or draw people to his house. You'll bring up a subject, and he used to say, I'm not anymore. Why don't you come to my house at 4 o'clock for tea? That's what he would say. And he would just draw a group of people in and hear everybody out. But you never had the sense that the decision was up for grabs. You never had the decision that we were just hoping that if a bunch of us get together, we'll think of something. You know. And Swami also says that real ideas have to come out of a sense of inspiration. And that he mentions, he said, once that inspiration is there, I often find myself, he writes, brushing aside people's brainstorms, because there's this true idea that just has so much more power than that. And so he's also really sort of trying to explain to us this delicate balance between how you really involve people, and what it is for people to really be involved in a way that's meaningful and not a way that just allows people to, what Swamiji once called, the sharing of mass ignorance, which is not necessarily, sometimes people consider that everybody needs to be allowed to do that. But Swami has this unusual way, and he hints at it here without being completely explicit, but it's true, is that he's very attentive as long as the individuals involved are making an attempt to tune in. But if they're only just talking from their own reality without making any attempt to tune in, he's not patient with it at all. And even more so, if the energy that they're putting out is